listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys over here on my right. We've got Martin Page.
Hi, Mike.
And next to him, we've got Scott Gershon.
Hi, Mike.
And across the table, we have Rob Arbatier.
Hello, Mike.
There is no Bobby, and there is no Andrew.
Oh. Are they together?
Hello, Mike.
I don't know. Scott, you weren't with Bobby and Andrew last time, were you?
Oh, actually, well, yeah. We had a little rendezvous, you know.
Bobby's up to his old tricks again, but he said he'd be here on the next one.
So. Did you bring up
the Bobby blow-up doll, though?
No Bobby blow-up doll.
Oh. It's been damaged.
And you know, if Bobby was here, he would have taking that one.
I just set it up and I'm just letting him, you know,
float away.
Playing the part of Bobby tonight is Scott Gershon.
Hello!
Before we get going, I wanted to do a few things. Number one, I wanted to thank, we had a couple of listeners that wrote in and basically sent their condolences for my grandmother passed away, and we were talking a little bit about that on the last podcast.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
So I thought that was very nice, you know, of them. And so we do know that our listeners, well,
they are compassionate.
They are compassionate and have a heart. So I thought that was really, really touching. So thank you for writing in. We're going to start with, right off the bat with, a piece of gear that I lent Rob.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a Big Ben.
By lent, you mean you want it back, right? is that how I'm supposed to understand
it? Exactly.
That?
And I thought it was really pretty timely because in this month's
timely
issue,
Big Ben, you know.
Yeah, I know. There was a whole thing. If, in case you don't know, a Big Ben is a digital clock, and there's a big article in Electronic Musician about digital clocking, and you hear all kinds of things about digital clocking. And Rob, you know, for the first time actually used the Big Ben and hooked it up to his Pro Tool system. Mm-hmm. And Rob, tell us a little bit about your digital clocking experience with the Big Ben.
It's actually been quite the ordeal trying to figure out what is the ultimate way to clock the studio, because I'm trying to just do it as well as it can be done right now. I'm trying to find the most stable clock and
the best
way to distribute
it. Why don't you explain a little bit
it.
About what a clock does for people out there that have no idea about digital clocking?
Well, when you're using digital recording equipment, it all has to be synchronized together so that the samples will line up, you know, from piece of gear to piece of gear. And generally, the best way to do it is to have one central clock that feeds everything so that everybody's synchronized to some solid source. And depending on what that source is, that's going to determine how good the studio sounds, basically. If you have clocking problems, you'll hear stereo images collapse. You'll hear, if it's really bad, you'll actually hear clicks and pops in the audio. The clock is probably the most important thing to get right. So I've been on this sort of odyssey to figure out what is the ultimate way to clock the studio. And I've checked out so many different clocks. Right now I've been listening to the Big Ben that you lent me, but also the Brainstorm DCD-8, the Prism A to D converter, called the ADA-8XR, which is, I think they call it their dream converter, which has a really stable clock. And also I've been using the Sync.io from Pro Tools and the Mutec iClock, and I think one or two more, just to see how these things affect the sound. And I also went to Audio Intervisual Design, where they have a bunch of test gear, and I brought all of this clocking equipment there to have them put it up on their test bench to actually see, you know, on a scope, on a digital scope, how these things are actually performing, because you can measure jitter. It's not just guesswork. You can get a very accurate measurement. And it turns out that basically most of the clocks that cost about the same, like the Big Ben and the Mutec and things in that price range, are all pretty comparable. There's a lot of marketing hype between them, and they have different features, but quality-wise, they're very similar in the jitter, and also in their error from proper sample rates. Like, you would think if you set a clock to 48K, which is super common, that a clock would put out 48K, but it turns out sometimes they're putting out 48,005 or 48,008.
Wow.
Or, you know, 47,900.
Did you try the internal 192 clock?
Yeah, we tried Pro Tools on internal. And what it turns out is that some gear is designed to be more stable when it's clocked to itself, and some gear is designed to be more stable when it's clocked externally. And I don't know what Digi would have to say about this, but it turns out that the Pro Tools hardware, the HD hardware, because of the way their loop sync works, is basically designed to be in a loop. So it's designed to be locking externally to something else. So the Pro Tools gear definitely behaves better when it's locked to something like the Big Ben or the Prism or something like that. And the other thing I found with these clocks is basically the newer it is, probably the more stable it is, which makes sense. And also the more expensive it is, probably the more stable it is.
Now, let me ask you a question. When you said the ones in the price range were comparable, you're talking about the Apogee, the Big Ben.
The Apogee Big Ben and the Mutech iClock were comparable because they're from sort of the same time period.
$1,500 for both of them? Because I know you can get like $1,500 for a Big Ben. I don't know how much the Mutech
is. Is ArtSync still a player?
It's about the same. Is what?
Is ArtSync still a player?
Not for HD systems. It isn't. That people still use them with their old mix systems, but not with HD rigs.
Right.
But the Brainstorm DCD8 is in the same kind of price range and sort of similar feature set, but it's newer technology and it was more stable because it's probably a 2 or 3 year newer design. The thing is, though, once you use any of these clocks with Pro Tools, my finding, and I'm going to be bringing you some audio recordings to hear to confirm this, my finding is that any of these clocks are definitely good enough. They all sound better than Pro Tools on internal.
Right.
And I don't know that most people could tell the difference between them. I mean, the Brainstorm clock might be $1,500 or $1,600 or maybe $1,700 by the time you add the video generators and everything else.
Right.
Actually, it may be cheaper than that. It may be more like $1,200 or $1,300 without them.
But I don't think you need video generators anymore. You
just you want to be able to sync up, it does HD sync if you want to do high def video decks and things like that.
Right.
But if
it'll do like tri-sync for video decks?
It will.
Wow.
It's the only one of them that'll do that. But the thing is that if you figure that averages in the $1,500 range and the Prism is more like $12,000,
right.
The Prism is more stable. It has a very expensive crystal in it. But I don't know that anybody would be able to
really
hear the difference.
It's not like $10,000.
Now, did you find that it was mostly recording information into it or doing re-records through plugins?
No. It's basically the performance of the A to D converters. It's when you're recording live audio.
So, but once it's inside it, it doesn't really affect it as much.
It does affect how it gets played back through the D to A's. But I found that you don't hear it as much on mono stuff, but on stereo stuff. Like if you have an acoustic guitar and you have one mic pointing at the hole and one mic pointing at the neck, say, and you do a nice stereo image, that image will seem to collapse if you don't have a real stable clock. It'll still sound good, and if you're not A-B-ing it with something else, it'll sound fine. But as soon as you actually can sit and hit a button and go between the two, you'll just hear that with a stable clock, even with the exact same A to D converters, it's going to sound better with the stable clock. It'll sound like a wider stereo image.
What about the D-Days? Does it affect it much, or mostly the A to Ds?
It does affect it, but I don't think as much as the A to Ds. And what I'm using is a source for this, because you have to do this with an analog source. And it has to be something reproducible. You can't expect a guitarist to play an absolute phase-accurate, similar performance every time. So what I've been using is a turntable with a half-speed master copy of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. And so I can play that. It's a very high-quality vinyl record. It has all kinds of transients that you would never find on a CD.
Right.
And I use that as my test case because it's reproducible. Every time you play it, it's identical.
Wow.
And that's a really good way to test A to D converters. And then you can also do the test with shakers and keys jingling and all the things that are also real hard for cheap A to D converters to
create. Hey, Martin, let me ask you in layman's terms.
Thank you for calling me a layman. Great introduction.
Okay. And
the ignorant one over there on the right.
All right, Martin.
It's actually the native
there. From a songwriter's point of view.
You should have said from someone above all this technology.
That's right, above all this technology. Now, can you describe, because I remember when we tried the Big Ben in your
studio. I'm spiritually above this, Mike. I don't know why you're asking me this.
I just want you to describe, you know, the differences that you saw, actually that you heard, in your music when we tried your Big Ben, locked up your Pro Tool system, because I thought it was pretty drastic.
I think it's interesting what Rob said. If you don't have anything to check it against, you can't really tell. And, there was a, a piece of gear that I used to use in my studio called a Dimension D, you know, Roland Dimension D. Yeah. And it used to be like an oral exciter, they called it. Sounds very exciting, doesn't it? but it used to just give the guitars and vocals that little bit of edge to get through on the mix. And I had the same kind of effect when we A and B'd without a clock and with a clock. I just found that it tightened the sound up. Mm-hmm. It brought a lot of the watery aspects of the song, or the drums might feel a little bit more spongy, and then suddenly when the clock was on it, everything was tight. Everything seemed to have its place better. And at first, it's a little bit difficult to tell, and you go, something's going on, but then after you discover it and you see it as clear as daylight.
It's right. Really, you kind of lock onto it then.
It's really obvious, and you can really see it. And in fact, I played it to a few people, RABs that we did at the studio, Mike, with you. And second listening, everybody heard it as well. You know, it's not as subtle as you think, but you just have to tune into it.
Did you record it in and then did another performance and recorded it?
Yeah, well, I noticed it when we were just making, as a layman, I was just making CDs, you know. So I put one CD down of one of my songs without it on, and then we do a CD after that with it on. And it was, I noticed it straight away. Everything, it was like shutting the doors on a car. It just tightened everything up, and there was a closure about the music.
And when you record your music, are you recording 96 or 48?
48.
Okay.
48,
and
yeah.
I should say something about sample rate, too. I think this has all been a real education, and it still is. I'm still doing some of the listening tests, but there are basically two kinds of clocks that are on the market. A clock like the Big Ben and some of the others I mentioned, it's a synthesized clock. It's whatever digital circuitry creating this clock. And then there are other clocks that are actually crystals that are resonating or vibrating at a certain frequency. And then there are, even more expensive than that, are pullable crystals that can lock to an input but then still vibrate like a crystal. And each one of these systems has a native sample rate that it'll perform best at. And most of the time, it's 44.1 or 44.056. And then everything else is a multiple of it. So, like, even with some of the really expensive clocks and converters I tested, they run best. Their jitter is lowest at 44.1. If you go up to 48, the jitter is not bad. It's still pretty good, but it's worse than at 44.1. And it seems like for most of these high-end systems that I've been looking at now, the ultimate sample rate for the lowest jitter is 88.2.
Wow.
Which is way higher than 48. So it's, you know, it's going to be noticeably better. But all these systems perform better at 88.2 than at 96, which is what everybody sells as the one you want to be using.
Are you going to be tracking more at 88?
Well, right now I'm past all the scientific tests and all the scopes, and we're just listening. So I'm recording similar things at all the different sample rates to see at what point it stops mattering.
You know, I did a test not long ago, which I'd be curious to even try musically, and that is when we now do location recording, we record at 96.24, and then what we do is we downsample to 48. We did a test where we recorded the exact same material to 48 straight and 96 converted to 48. And even the stuff that was converted from 96 to 48 sounded significantly better.
Hmm.
It sounded clearer. It's the difference between normal TV and HD TV.
Mm.
It was not even subtle.
Wow.
So, like, while we don't – all our masters now are 96. But we don't work in 96 because there's no delivery format yet at 96.
So it's 48 you basically move out?
We do at 48, but we don't record anything at 48 now because we found – that just converting
recording at 96 and coming back is better.
Yeah, just recorded it, put it into a track, convert it down to 48, and it sounds tighter, punchier.
Mm. Well, a lot of people say they work at 44.1 because that's what the CD is going to end up being.
Right.
But the truth is it sounds so much better if you work at a higher sample rate and then convert it down properly. Right. If you're going to run it through some El Cheapo terrible converter at the end, then yeah, you shouldn't do that.
I mean, but my only guess is that when they convert it, they're using all 48K and all, you know.
Right.
Meanwhile, when you're recording it, it might not quite.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
You know.
Hey, Martin, as an AC god.
Thank you very much.
That's a better intro, actually.
No, where would you put, how important is the clock in your, it's $1,500 and you're putting together a studio. I mean, it's like, if you have a small pie, where do you put that slice, you know, for the clock? I mean, how much would you say monitors, DAW, clock, or great microphone, or
I think it struck me when I went from analog to digital, when you were helping me put the studio in, that everything I'd read, that if you're going into the Pro Tools land, you needed a good clock. I mean, everything I read at that time, everything pointed to saying, for your studio to be optimum, you need to look at the clock. So I think, if I remember rightly, we did think that was one of the major things to put in. Yeah. So, you know, past the monitors and, you know, the amount of tracks I had to use, I thought the clock at the beginning was going to be very important, primarily because I looked at all the magazines and read about it, and I knew that in the digital world it was going to be very, very important. And it is. I mean, I did notice a difference. You know, it really is the difference between fog and a little bit of sunlight coming through. That's what.
And didn't it kind of justify the expense automatically? Yeah. I mean, you hear it and you say, whatever that cost, we need that sound.
Yeah, I mean, if you told me now we're taking the clock out, you know, I'd be screaming blue murder, because it's like I've begun to rely on it a little bit, knowing that it's something I can trust. I wanted to ask you, Rob, if out of all the tests you're doing, is there one that you'd say, if I had to make a choice, I would go with this? Because, you know, relating to the price and what it does and everything.
Well, if money is no object... which it's always fun to play around in that
world.
No,
I don't mean that, but I mean a reasonable, you know, all round that you say that's extraordinary.
Cost
price.
Versus...
Well, I think the goal is the manufacturers know that clocks are going to be from $1,000 to $2,000. It's going to fall around, you know, some of them will be $1,200 or $1,300, some will be $1,600 or $1,700, depending on the feature set. If they all have the same feature set, I would say your best bet is to just get whatever's the newest design, because these designs are only getting better. I mean, for right now, the most stable... one that I found is that Brainstorm. It's the newest.
That's interesting.
It has a cool feature set. It's got, you know, a bunch of outputs of different kinds, and it's just really cool. Mm. I don't know that you could hear a difference between it and the Big Ben. That's what I'm actually figuring out now, and I'll be able to let you know that by next time.
So for those people that are mixing this stuff, if they're not actually recording it, but they're mixing it, manipulating it with plugins, etc., you're basically saying then the clock becomes less of an issue.
No, you know what? That's not true.
Because I'm also thinking for post-production.
No, it's not true.
Definitely an issue.
It'll take, even if you've recorded, you know, elsewhere without a clock, as soon as you put it on your system, I liken it to, it just makes everything in focus. It's like... Mm-hmm.
Because you are doing D to A conversion.
Yeah. Like, I know that in the ArtSync, it was a night and day with the old Pro Tools mix systems.
Right.
Then the HD sounded so much better, you know, overall. So you're saying now that on the HD,
it makes a difference. It's not as huge a difference as the ArtSync was for the mix system, but it's definitely noticeable. I mean, I'll be able to play you guys files where you hear the exact same source material run through these different converters. And I'm doing these tests. I borrowed everything, so I'm doing these tests with the 192's built-in converters and these Prism converters too, which are, you know, super tweaky ones. There is a difference, but you just have to make the decision at some point. What's it worth?
Right.
But I think you should, if you're putting together a studio, definitely plan on $1,200 to $1,500 for a good clock.
How did the Digi A to Ds hold up?
Surprisingly well, if they're clocked right. If they're clocked right, they're incredibly good, especially for the price.
But are they Big Ben good?
Well, the Big Ben makes them better.
Yeah, I know.
No, I would say you have, you know, I've talked to salesmen from different companies, and they'll say, well, what do you use for your A to D converters? For your Pro Tools, and I'll say, well, we just use the 192s. And you can actually hear them just, you know, curling over themselves in disgust at, oh my God, how can you possibly use that garbage? Meanwhile, the truth is, if you sit down on a listening test, they sound excellent. Mm-hmm. And I'm comparing them with all the stuff that these guys are trying to sell us, too.
And the report is, at the end of the day, it still goes through the iPod with the little, you know, converter.
The other thing, too, is about the clock, too, especially, like, you know, the early adopters, like the Big Bands and the guys that kind of, you know, define this whole clocking category. A lot of people were so blown away because they're hearing clocking for the first time. Mm-hmm. And now we're getting to the point where you can actually start to compare the different clocks that are out there.
Well, I think the ArtSync is the first one that got everybody.
Yeah,
it was the first
true.
Time people could really hear a difference. It wasn't just, you know, audiophile tweaky guys trying to sell gear. You could actually really hear the difference when you plugged it in.
So do you ever think there'll be a vintage clock market?
Probably.
I've got an ArtSync if anybody wants to know.
Yeah.
You know what? That's the thing with digital gear, isn't it? There is no vintage market for that.
None whatsoever.
Everybody wants to buy gear, have a big garage.
Yeah.
Because there's just no resale value. I mean,
nothing.
A Dash recorder now goes for what? You know,
$3,000.
Well, I know for a fact. A friend just bought a Mitsubishi X850, right. The 1-inch 32-track right. machine for $3,000.
Man, those used to be like
hundreds of thousands of dollars.
$500,000.
Ascent Media started closing down some of their studios. We closed down Signet and all these amazing studios, and they got rid of all the 24 tracks. It looked like a parade. We must have had 40, you know, between Studers and Atari just lined up.
Two-inch machines?
Two-inch machines, one-inch machines. And it was, and they've been, you know, it's just sad. Sinclaviers.
Wow.
We had 3 Sinclaviers. We had like 100 wave frames. You know, just, and they were just all stacked, and it was like, you want it?
Yeah.
It's just worthless.
Doorstops.
And the Sinclaver was $350,000, wow. I remember.
But you know what? I always say the same thing. If you buy any of this gear, the investment you're making is in what you're going to be able to do with it as quickly as possible.
Right.
You know, any gear, if you're creative, will pay for itself pretty quickly if you use it right.
The crazy thing is all these, you know, formats, they have to stick around. You know, you have to have at least one of those machines because there's so many tapes that are out there that are recording right. in the format. And this gets us back to what we were talking about before about
jazz drives.
Yeah, about data storage and things like that. And because this is the Audio Nowcast,
we could only beam in an expert or two on this very topic.
Hey, wait.
Does anybody here do sound effects?
We happen to have a couple of experts.
Surprise guests.
It's not like they're rocket scientists or anything.
No, we wouldn't be able to afford them.
Actually, Rob brought in some experts, and let me introduce them to everybody. We have Ann Rao.
Yes.
Hi.
Hello, Ann.
See, okay, she's an arc. Oh, man.
It takes a half hour to say what
it's a hard one to say.
Let's see if Mike can get it out.
I can do it. Archiving planetary data expert.
Good.
There you go.
Me.
As well as having a...
And a programmer.
And having a degree in music.
I have a bachelor's degree in music theory.
Look at that. See, there's the whole tie-in.
We'll all leave at this point.
And you're with the University of Maryland, is that right?
That's true, yes.
And then also sitting next to her, we have Bill Knopf, who is a program executive for Planetary Data System over at NASA.
Yeah,
that is true. All right.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Audio Nowcast. We were talking on a podcast about storage, about the digital media, and about, you know, what musicians can do, you know, what's the best way to archive this stuff, because it just seems like things are changing all the time. And I just want to get... You know, your opinion on data itself. I mean, how do you look at data? Should we look at data as kind of like an organic thing that we just kind of have to keep putting in a lot of different baskets? Or is there going to be a place where we can just sit it on a shelf and know that in 10, 15 years that we can come back to it?
Talk about the shelf life of a DVD.
This week
we had dinner right before we came.
Talk about pertinence.
Yeah, it's somewhere between the length of time it actually takes to write the data on it in the first place. And it's looking like about 5 years.
That's it?
Five years for a DVD,
We
folks.
Are being advised by our media guys who have been looking into the question. We have a guy who used to do this for a living and is now retired and touring the world in an RV and testing DVD media, that we should check the DVDs that we write for archival purposes as soon as we write them, which is a good idea because the failure rate on the media is embarrassing if you care about this sort of thing. And a year later, and then every 3 years, and that we should be thinking about refreshing the media on a 5 to 8 year sort of timeline.
Wow.
And tell them, we tell them why.
What's
happening with the DVDs that's creating the errors?
Well, first of all, there's really shoddy manufacturing practices. I have thrown away entire spindles of 100 DVD blanks. And we're not talking about double density or double layered. These are simple 4.7 gig, single layer, single density DVDs, single-sided DVDs. And the first 8 generated read errors that you could see by turning over the disc and seeing dark bands in the middle of the place that you've just written. Not the nice smooth outline where the writing stopped, but uneven bands like bad weaving. And it's dye spread, and it's just bad manufacturing processes. And you can throw the disc right out there because a good section of it's going to be unreadable.
So basically, if you're going to start just doing your first write, and this is going to be an archive thing, you should flip the disc over and take a look at it.
The first thing we do is visual inspection, as we say in the biz. Mm-hmm. Yeah, flip it over and look, because if you can see some variation in the surface of the DVD, there's a problem right there. Give up and try again. And I did this on 8 discs out of the top of a spindle, and all of them were bad, and I threw out the rest because it's not worth my time.
Wow.
The second thing we do is we do a checksum, which actually forces on something other than the writer that wrote the disc.
Do you
want to
say what a checksum is?
A checksum is calculated by taking all the bytes and applying an algorithm, a formula. You add it or you multiply it or something like that. And it's accumulated in a certain number of bytes. And the idea is that the formula that is used is extremely likely to produce a unique number. And the checksums we use are 128 hex digits long, so it's the number 0 through 9. 8,
so you're comparing the two things together.
Right, and the thing is that if even one bit changes somewhere in the file, the checksum will be different.
Hmm.
And you can't fake the checksum. The algorithm is so complicated and there's so much fluctuation based on little tiny dependencies that if you wanted to replace a file with another file, one that had a virus or one that had changed information, if you're in the spy game, it would be impossible to force a particular checksum and get the result that you wanted. Now, we use it because it gives us a unique number that tells us whether anything's been corrupted, which is what we're worried about, accidental corruption. And the second thing is, in order to generate the checksum, you have to actually read every single byte in the file. Everything gets read. And so frequently I don't have checksum failures. I have I/O errors. There are sections of the disk that I can't read. Some byte somewhere was unreadable. And that I can't have a disk that it takes 10 tries to read a byte, let alone one that has an I/O error. And I have to throw it out and start over again. And I've had we don't write as many disks as some other nodes. We have nodes with production line systems, a DVD creation system where you put the disk in one side, it creates the disk, it runs a checksum, and if it's good, it comes out one slot, and if it's bad, it falls into the waste basket on the other side. And I'm being told that even on pretty good manufactured disks, they're getting failure rates of 20%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing to keep in mind, like if you're burning a DVD video or CD audio for yourself, it's full of errors.
Right.
And it doesn't matter because the player kind of corrects them. And unless it's a huge, massive number of errors, you're not going to see it or hear it because the machine will smooth it over and just play it back. But if you're trying to back up your data, you know, you don't want your accounting files or something to just be kind of close to accurate.
It
needs to be exact.
What scares me for the two sound designers out there actually listening to this podcast is that a lot of times we will go to exotic places, one of a time, things that we'll record, sounds that we record, and a lot of times what people will do is they will record it, they'll use it for a project, put it on a hard drive, then they'll say, you know what, I don't have a project like that anymore coming up. I'll just back it up to DVD, shelve it, and then when that project comes back,
right,
I'll bring it up, then they bring it up and they find out they can't open the files. And that's huge.
Is this just for DVDs, or what about like Blu-rays and HD DVDs?
Blu-rays and HD DVDs, because we're doing data archiving, which requires a sort of lower, more stable standard, we're not using them yet. Yeah. So the formats that we're writing in are all ISO 9660 or ISO 9660 bridge to UDF.
Can you tell them what kind of stuff you're backing up?
We are backing up data from NASA missions and ground-based observations funded by NASA. So a lot of it, for our particular specialty, comets, asteroids, interplanetary dust, is tables of numbers. It's ASCII for the most part. We do have some images, but when one byte goes wrong in an ASCII table, there's a pretty good chance you'll notice it. If one byte goes wrong in an image, you know, maybe not so much.
Right.
But our data files are small. They're relatively simple. They're pretty well behaved. And our disks are just full of documentation files in ASCII, some PDF, these image files that are straight images, not in any sort of compressed format.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fairly straightforward data, but it is specifically our job to make sure that none of it disappears.
Well, let me ask you, Ann, just for the listeners out there, what are some of your recommendations if you have some, you know, critical song files and you have some, you know, your music or just in general, what would you recommend would be a really good backup archiving strategy?
I prefer to have at least two copies in two different formats. So the data that we're putting on DVD, we also have in a RAID array, which has its own redundancy and recovery possibilities. And that RAID array is also backed up to another RAID array. And an occasional deep archive on tape is made. So they're all in kind of the same physical location, but each one of those formats is susceptible to different sorts of disasters. And so apart from the building burning to the ground, which would take a while because it was built in the 60s, it's sturdy, it's a bomb shelter, the flooding damage that would take out the RAID array right. and probably a magnetic tape copy isn't going to affect the DVDs. But it does mean that we have to make a long-term commitment to refreshing the various formats. You can't just copy the data off onto a RAID array, unplug it, put it in a shelf in a closet, and expect it to be there 5 years from now.
Gotcha.
You have to exercise it. You have to refresh the data. Magnetic media are volatile. They're subject to oxidation. If you don't keep the bits fresh, you will start to lose them. So multiple copies on multiple different types of media is, and I do actually the same thing at home. I have memory stick copies of photos that I care about, and I also have a couple CD copies. And
to keep these in different places, maybe?
Generally well. Speaking, yeah. I've got a fireproof box where I put, CDs just seem to be much more reliable than DVDs, probably because the bits are physically much larger.
Mm. I gotcha.
It takes a lot more to lose a bit from a CD than it does from a DVD.
Wow, that's good to know. So if you can back up on a CD...
Well, then, yeah.
If it'll fit.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you, with DVDs, not that I'm asking for an endorsement, but have you ever found certain brands to be a little bit more reliable than other brands?
No, and I haven't done the research. This is a discussion I had with the what we call the Planetary Plasma Interactions Node, which is actually out here at UCLA. It's where we were just meeting. They were hosting our meeting. They did some extensive research and discovered that it's not really the manufacturer's name, although there are some manufacturers who are generally better. It's the factory that produces the disc.
Right.
And since you can't find that out until you open the package and actually look at the hub information that's on pre-stamped on the disc,
right.
you don't know which factory it was, and there's no guarantee that there's not a one-to-one relationship between factories and manufacturers. So there are some manufacturers, ones that I haven't heard of, because I'd give you the name if I could remember it reliably,
sure.
who tend to go with the higher quality factories, but there's no universal.
I got you.
So it's extremely frustrating.
You know, this is a similar situation. We were talking at dinner that digital cinema is on the brink of coming out. They're talking in the next 5 years that they're probably going to stop using film. And it's all going to be digitally based. The problem is, where do they put it? It's such huge amounts of data.
Right.
And not only that, but they want to be able to re-release it later on in, you know, YouTube or something. And, you know, what do they do with it? When they make a film, they want to archive it. Where do they archive it? How do they archive it? What formats? And one of the things we were talking about, like, when you archive something in a Pro Tools format, well, you know, we've been around long enough. I've seen so many workstations come and go. You know, how many people can take their SyncLivar library and or a Kai library or, you know, you can go on and utilize it again. It's a dead format.
Yeah.
So you've got to find ways of refreshing it into the new data formats.
Well, we talked about that on another podcast about how, like, a lot of high-end recording artists, they're archiving the machines along with the data. So you may not be able to find a SyncLivar 20 years from now to play back your data, but if you archive one of those and have a tech maintain it this whole time, then you'll be able to play it. But obviously, that's a really expensive way to go.
I'll put a plug in here because we got bought out by a company called Ascent Media.
Right.
And one of Ascent Media's biggest and actually most successful divisions is the archival division. And they're doing nothing now but, like, Disney will say, hey, you know what, we need a QuickTime of this or an EPK, or they're just basically a giant transfer company and they're ingesting all of this data of their shows to come out in whatever format they need.
Wow. Well, we want to thank you, Ann and Bill, and feel free to, you know, chime in on some of the other topics we're gonna take on. But we're gonna take a break right now, and when we come back, we're gonna talk a little bit about freelance disasters and a couple other things. So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by AFEX and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before we took the break, we were talking a little bit about archiving. But what was really amazing is we got in a little discussion about clocking. And clocking is not only pertinent to music, but as I found out that clocks in spaceships are really important things. And just for, you know, just explain a little bit about the clock in a spaceship and what role it plays.
Sure. Every spacecraft has to have some sort of internal clock. And typically they'll have something that's like an ultra-stable oscillator source that they're able to make sure that it's really working at the appropriate rate. And everything is recorded, synced to that. We have everything from instrument data, because, you know, the reason we send these spacecraft out is they have instruments on board that are taking some sort of measurements, either video type thing, a camera measurement, or measurements of a magnetic field of something. But all of that is being recorded, and it's being recorded in such a way that it has what's called a UTC time, or coordinated universal time, tagged to it. All that data is played back to us, and then we have ground receipt times that we have to deal with. And we have to calculate out if we have any round trip light time calculations as far as, you know, how long it takes to get a command from the ground to the spacecraft. The spacecraft is far away. You know, it's only traveling at the speed of light.
Right.
So all that has to be taken into effect.
So everything has to be in sync.
And it has to all be synced up.
Much like multi-tracks, everything has to be in sync.
But a spacecraft like Voyager, it takes a couple days for light to reach that far,
It's about 2 days one way to get a signal from here to where the Voyager spacecraft is now.
Wow.
Where they are. I mean, because they've actually left the solar system, okay, which is mind-numbing when you think about it.
Wow.
They've actually left the influence of the sun's heliopause.
Crossed the heliopause.
Yes, yeah. It's really bizarre. And so it's not the sort of thing that you're able to say, oh, rats, you know, I need to do something now.
Right.
Click. No. You know, by the time you get a response, it's 4 days later.
Wow.
Yeah, you can't hook up a word clock cable.
No.
But you know what? It's coming back because I saw Star Trek, the motion picture, so I know.
That's right. It does kind of, but it's called V'ger then,
I know.
Right?
It will be back. So, and you have, you know, clocking errors just like you have in a studio and things of that nature, and you deal with drift. Okay, I got two questions. Number one, drop frame, non-drop frame?
is it even time code?
I know.
It's real time, right?
Well, time code was actually great in NASA.
So we got time code and Tang.
And Tang. So is it a form of time code that you use?
I don't know. I'd have to defer to the hardware guy.
It depends on the spacecraft. But, you know, frequently things are to, you know, tens of milliseconds of
hours. So after seconds goes milliseconds.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, I've learned one thing. Digital clocking, it is rocket science.
It is.
Apparently it is. Absolutely.
In your own studio.
That's right.
No wonder we can't figure it out.
I wonder if they got a big band.
It's not
there.
Nuclear science.
No, I guess not.
Wow. Well, boy, thanks, guys. That's really fascinating. We could do a whole podcast on this.
We almost have.
Yeah, I know.
Our shared pain.
Yes.
That's right. So there's some real-world applications, you know, and here we are in our studios. We're thinking we're dealing with things that are, you know, unique to us. But
well, Bill said when we went to the break that all the stuff we were talking about with the clocking of studios was hitting home for them.
Yeah.
One last question for you. When you were talking about clocks, how much clocking are you doing through the AES port rather than a BNC to a word clock port?
Well,
because a lot of gear doesn't have a BNC.
Yeah, a lot. Word clock is the most common way to clock gear together, but there is such a thing as AES black, which is just like video black. You know, video black is sort of the sync signal from a video signal, but there's no picture, there's no image. And AES black is the same thing. It's all the clocking information from the AES digital audio signal, but no actual audio data, just the clock.
Well, no, but like I know that like my Pro Tools and the Eventide 8000 that I've got, I'm running digitally. It derives the clock from the AES port.
Right. There's some variation in the way different devices derive the clock from the AES port. If possible, I'm told it's better to put an AES black signal instead of an AES audio signal, but there's variation in the way different gear derives that clock. What I was told is with a well-designed circuit, there should be no quality difference between AES black or word clock. It ends up being the identical amount of jitter, say.
But that means you have to have an XLR word clock input. But there's a lot of gear.
No, you can't hook word clock to AES. They're two completely separate things. But I'm saying they're both as good as a timing reference. It's just totally different circuitry.
But I know the PCM80 and some of those, I don't think they've got a separate word clock input.
No, but they're locked to their SPDIF or AES EBU input.
Exactly.
Any device that's set up to get its clock from its input.
Yes.
Usually you don't have a choice, so yeah, like with the PCM80, it doesn't have a word clock input, so you just use. Does it even have AES or is it SPDIF? I don't remember.
No, it's AES.
AES.
So that's fine.
I think it's both.
Just like with a D to A converter, I've been experimenting with, is there a difference between sending it a word clock or not, or just letting it get its clock from the audio signal coming in? And most D to A converters are happy just getting the signal from the audio coming in.
You know, over at the SoundLux, we've actually gotten rid of all of HowSync.
Wow.
We don't need it anymore because there's so many editing rooms that it's all based on word clocks, which means everyone needs their own word clock because of the distances.
You mean HowSync meaning video HowSync?
Video HowSync is
now. Yeah, video HowSync is gone, but word clock HowSync is still very useful.
Well, no, we're actually going internal on all the machines because we no longer use tape. Everything's QuickTime movies within the Pro Tools session, and for us to be able to do sync.
You're not running AES between the systems? They're each standalone?
They each standalone.
Oh, so yeah, you don't need it.
See? It is rocket science.
Yeah, exactly.
Once again.
Hey, I wanted to change the topic really quick. I had a friend of mine who had a really bad freelance situation that came up where he essentially was trying to negotiate a job, and it wasn't, you know, the producers, and I use that term lightly, you know, kept on jerking him around as far as, you know, what their budget was. And they finally, you know, after he invested time with, you know, meeting with them and stuff, they told him what the budget, it was really low, and he ended up not taking it. And they ended up, you know, basically smearing his name. And he was just asking me, you know, how do you avoid situations? How do you price yourself? How do you keep from getting like these nightmares as a freelancer that he gets in? And so, I just wanted to open that up to you guys about pricing yourself as a freelancer. How do you do it? You know, do you have any rules? Do you have any little nuggets of information that you can share to the listeners out there as to, you know, how to price yourself, how to sell yourself as a freelancer, avoiding freelance nightmares?
That's a tough one. I would have to say, still to this day, if I give somebody a price for a job, for doing a job, and they say okay right away, I hate that. I hate that. I always want them to have to think about it or to say, ooh, or something like that, and then come back and say okay. But if they just, you know, if I say, well, I'll do that job for $1,000, and they go, excellent, sure, go. Oh, no, that was a wrong answer. I meant $10,000.
Well, you know, let me just tell you, I'll give a piece of advice to people out there because I do a lot of freelance work. I do a ton of freelance work. And right off the bat is I have an idea of what my worth is. And I think when you go into a freelance situation, you kind of have to know how much you want to make, you know? So right off the bat, I think if you have a number in your head that you'll work for this amount of money, you know, don't be afraid to walk away if it doesn't reach what you're worth, because you're going to end up, you know, hating yourself for not sticking to your guns.
Well, you can also shoot yourself in the foot because if you're upset as you're trying to do the job about what you're making to do the job, and you end up not producing the quality of work that you would like to be known for, it's going to come back to get you.
Well, I for a long time have had the equation that I use, which is how much do I need to be paid for this job to not want to kill somebody by the time it's over? You know, I don't want to regret on that last day of work feeling like, well, you know what, their dime ran out a week ago and I'm still working on this thing.
Right. And it's not like I'm, you know, and I'm not saying, you know, price yourself high. I'm just saying you have to live with yourself for whatever you're doing that job is.
Yeah, think about what it's like at the end of the job.
Exactly. And Scott, were you going to say something?
I was going to say something, but I was like, you guys finish. You know, I heard a story when I was a little boy. I'm going to try not to screw this up. Okay, here's a story, okay? Guy goes to this little kid, goes, all right, I got two coins. One's a quarter, one's a dime. Which one do you want? Kid looks at it and goes, I'll take the dime. The guy goes, this is the stupidest kid. Brings a friend over, says, I'm going to show you the stupidest kid I've ever seen. Grabs a quarter and a dime, goes to the kid, which do you want? Quarter or the dime? Kid looks, thinks, takes the dime. This guy's totally blown away. Starts grabbing some more friends. Goes over and says, this is the stupidest kid you've ever seen. Okay, watch this. Quarter and a dime. which do you want? Kid looks at it and says, I take the dime. So finally, after a while, all these people show up. One guy stops the kid and says, hey, I got to ask you, why do you keep taking the dime? Because he goes, the moment I take the quarter, the game will stop. This guy keeps giving me dimes. I'm making a lot of money. And there's something, the way I came into this business, I actually was the kid that took the dime. Because when I started at the company I was at, I was actually competing against somebody who had a Sinclair, had tons of gear. His price was high. My price was reasonable. I'm not going to say it's low, but it was reasonable. So they said, well, this guy's really good, the other guy, and we'll use him when we need him. Next thing I know, I'm working all the time. So at the end of the year, I'm making significantly more money, and I've got a certain amount of stability. The other guy can claim he's making more money per day than I was, but he wasn't working as much. So with that said, I always feel philosophically the way I go after gigs. I kind of figure how much money is the most that I could make and dial it back one notch. Because the moment you make top dollar at the top of your game, you're always expendable.
Right.
And the thing is, and you're going to be judged higher.
Yeah.
They're going to go, this guy's good, but he didn't really perform as well. Yeah. And they'll find reasons to find fault. Meanwhile, if you work for them, they go, you know what? It was okay, but this guy's been very reasonable. We hire him time and time again. He's solid. You'll be the kid with the dime. You'll make more money in the long run if you price yourself reasonably than trying to make as much money from one gig.
Now, that's a great point because, you know, whenever I negotiate a salary or anything, I'm with you. I don't want to be on the top and I'm not going to be on the bottom. I'm going to be at a good place in the middle or maybe I've been doing this for a while and I've done a lot. So maybe a little bit above the middle, but it's definitely, there's room, there's room to grow. There's room, to go up, and it really, I think, it's really weird, when you talk about salaries, especially in audio, because there's a certain amount of, especially in this town, there's this stigma of respect, and there's this, ooh, this guy must be really great because he's commanding this amount of money, whether it's in post or music or whatever. And in reality, if you look at some of those guys that are, the top dollar guys, they're not doing anything different than you or me. And yet at the same time, if you kind of want to, set yourself up there, you kind of have to, in some ways command that kind of salary.
It has nothing to do. I work in a business where people make stupid money.
Right.
To be honest. And, it has nothing to do with how good you are. It has to do with how good people think you are.
Right.
And when people think that you are doing great things and some of it might just be smoke and mirrors, whatever, the client's got to feel that there's a value. We go against music all the time. I know a lot of composers that are making hundreds of thousands of dollars in residuals for movies. I mean, they're making significantly more money in residuals than I make in a year. And just in residuals, forget about the new movies they're doing. Why? Because there's a perceived more value that what they do adds more to the project.
Right.
Same reason why Julia Roberts is worth more than Kate Hudson. Because she perceives more value for moviegoers that people are going to want to see. It's all about perceived value. So when you look at, different industries, I've seen a lot of audio people, including musicians going, nobody appreciates what we do and we're not valued enough and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
There's a sound designer that legend has it, so I'll say it's a legend. But there was a sound designer who, Gary Rydstrom, there, was a legend where he was offered $1 million to become an in-house sound guy a year because his perceived value for that company was such where they said, that's a deal.
Right.
And that's significantly more. Whether it's true or not, who knows? It could be a big fish story.
Right.
But there is about perceived value, and I think that if you want to sell yourself and make more money, you got to have the clients think that you are the.
No, that's true. Let's go on the other side though. Here's something that I think is really wrong that's happening nowadays too. Is you get the guy that has the laptop who just came out of recording school. And who's driving the market on the bottom end, way down, way, way down. So now you have producers out there that are, really taking advantage of, of people and wanting to do, you know, network shows or, you know, syndicated shows for, you know, sound and mix and everything with the editing for like, you know, $800 a show or something like that. And that's just, you know, that's just ridiculous. You know, I mean, there's, you know, and there's people out there that'll take that gig.
You get what you pay for.
Well, that's true.
I mean, it is. I mean, if you feel comfortable that your investment that you're going to make millions on and you're going to put that bit of responsibility to a kid just out of college, then knock yourself out. And
you may get lucky.
You might get lucky and you might not. And again, you have to figure out what the or look, there are definitely industries that take advantage of reality shows. I mean, they don't even fake it. They editors, it's non-union, they do a lot of stuff that is wickedly cheap. And that's great. That's a market then you stay away from.
Right.
Or I mean, listen, you enjoy doing it and it's stable for you, and but if not, you learn in that marketplace, you get as much as you can and you move on. But it is competition. You've got to compete. You've got, you know, we were talking about music, and everybody wants to have that hit album, whether it be an audio engineer, a synthesist, a session player, probably a rocket scientist. you know, you've got to be able to compete against the other guys that are doing the same stuff, and you've got to say, look, you can hire them, but you're not going to get this, and you got to be a salesman.
Yeah, that's right. You know what? That's really a great point. If number one, you got to know your worth. Number two is you got to provide added value. You know, if you want people to come back to you, you've got to give them something. You got to give them a reason to come to you. You got to give them a reason to choose you above somebody else.
And I know guys that made a ton of money on cheap guys. They said, "Great, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do your gig and two other guys' gigs at the same time, and then I'll figure something out." So they end up doing more work. Because if you don't care about the quality, I'll give you crap. I'm just going to give a lot of people crap at the same time. Next thing they do, $800 gig times three, yeah, they make it $2,400 a week.
Yeah, except it's taking them, you know, 20 hours to do that.
Hey, you know what? Here's a reality. I feel like I'm the only one talking to you. To make money takes time and energy.
Right.
The concept of free money, I get probably 10 to 15 resumes a day. In what I do, and everyone's looking for a quick buck, and everyone doesn't want to really commit and work hard. You can make a lot of money in the entertainment industry if you really commit to it, but it ain't an easy gig. It's going to be ups and downs. It's going to be stress, and if you want to play the game, then join it, but it ain't easy, and you got to get in it and work it.
You know,
ain't for the faint of heart.
No, that's a good point, and let me bring up something else. You know what? If you're going to take a gig, you live and die on that gig and that gig alone. And what I mean is, you know, people are going to promise you all kinds of stuff. You know, they're going to promise you that on the next one, you're going to be doing this. And as the
that's never going to happen.
That's never going to, it's never going to happen. So take that gig and throw the promises out the window and just say if you want to do that gig or you don't want to.
I've said this in the past. If you do a demo for somebody like for free and they say, well, we want you to do this because, you know, when we have a real budget, we'll come back and hire you. The moment you get known as the guy who does free demos, guess what? All you get called for is free demos. Yeah. As soon as they have real money, they go to the guy who's known as the guy who you pay real money to.
Yeah, they're not gonna come back to you.
But you know what you really want in the beginning of your career and throughout your career? I don't know if you guys find this in what you guys do, but I find that when you are in – how do I say this without getting bleeped? When you are in a terrible situation where everybody is in pain and hurting based on hours, based on stress, what happens is a bonding occurs. I find when I do projects that are good, everything's happy, everything's smooth, everyone says, oh, this is great, see you later. There's no bond. There's no connection. But when you've sweated together on projects and been through some, you know, combat together, we did Team America, and we were doing 20-hour days for 14 days straight. That hotel, we were sleeping 3 hours a day. We would start another reel at 4 in the morning. You know, we were sleeping from 12 to 3. It was crazy. We all talk about that, and we're all, like, bonded. And I think that a lot of business, I don't care what you're in, is based on relationships.
Right.
Absolutely. So when you guys say doing favors, you know what? Right now, I'm doing a favor to the guy that produced the movie Transformers. And I did one of his movie. His wife, it's while she was out, Kim Basinger film, really good. anyway, give him a little plug. Anyway, he came to me and said, look, I've got a film, we're not really distributed yet. Can you give me a hand? It's all about relationships. And look, you know what? A lot of times it's going to come out to nothing, but how many times do you need a big a lift. If you play the odds, it'll be in your favor. Though I do agree not working for free.
Yeah, I was going to say, your favor came after the relationship existed.
Exactly, and that's the thing to remember.
Sure.
I'll do tons of favors for people I've had a long relationship with or people we've done real work with because they then appreciate that it's a favor.
Right.
But along that favor, you might find a guitar player who all of a sudden goes, man, I'm getting ripped off just as bad as you are. Next thing you know, he has a gig and says, I met this great keyboard player, engineer, who's got the studio at his house. You should check this guy out. Next thing, it's a relationship.
Well, yeah, and it all depends if you can afford to do that, I would imagine. But if you're, you know, if you're going to be working on, not at that level, but just on a, hey, I've got this, you know, student film and it's 15 minutes and I've got $200, you know, and it's going to take you.
Bill Brown, good instant, with Serafian. He did a favor for a guy project, took him all the way. He went from games. He's now doing music for CSI all of a sudden. And he's got this great career going. He's been winning BMI awards. All of a sudden, this is done with a favor because the guy was doing a little script at the time, didn't have any money. I think for people starting in the business.
No, I agree. I see what you're saying.
I mean, if you're doing favors, it's 4 or 5 years into your career.
Yeah.
And all you're doing is favors, then yeah, you got to think about
it. No. You know what? I don't want to dissuade people from taking that student film, but at the same time, you know, you got to be smart and you got to think about, you know, just see if it works. See if you like it. See if you find something else other than the money to work for.
Well, that's a great. But you just said something really interesting, and that is, if you're going to do a favor, make sure when you see the project, you go, "Oh my God, this is an amazing project. I will absolutely do a favor." I did a favor. I worked for free for a year and a half for a buddy of mine. A director had a friend who had a film called Two Soldiers. And I saw the film, and I went, this is amazing. It was short. Alan Silvestri donated his time. I donated mine. It wasn't like this guy was a big director. It was a favor. But we loved the project. We did it. We worked on it on and off for a year. Didn't make a penny. He won an Oscar for it.
Hmm.
Because when you see a project and you believe in it.
Right.
And right now he's trying to figure out what his next project's going to be. But we've become vast friends.
Right.
He's introduced me to other people, other directors, other picture cutters. Because we're just friends. It's relationships. So I think that if you do a freebie or you do a favor, if it's a piece of crap and you're going to do it, then what's the point?
Right.
But if you see something, you find a young, up-and-coming talent.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I agree. And there's times where I still do that. If I see a project, you know, especially I do a lot of documentaries. I've done gazillions of documentaries. And if I find one that I like just the subject, I don't even care what they're going to pay because – you know, that'll be a piece of gear for the studio or something.
You want the documentary director who goes, I've made documentaries for the last 10 years. I'm going to make my first feature film.
Yeah.
And you go, this guy's amazing. And you go, whatever I can do to help you on that path.
And you know what? I will find out if you find those gem clients that kind of grow with you, and you do a couple of projects with them. You know, as long as you're reasonable and you've have established a good relationship, you know, they'll bring you aboard some projects, you know, and as they grow up, in their career. I'm actually going to be working on a feature documentary that started off as a smaller project for a museum. And I've done a lot of projects with these people and now we're doing this feature doc. And it's just, you know, you just have to really, like you were saying, you got to cultivate those relationships.
And I think whenever you do a favor, just be clear why you're doing it. And be sure that it's a project, like Scott was saying, that you'd be proud of and be happy to be involved with, even if there was nothing down the road could come of it.
Yeah.
You should do it because it's something you're happy to be doing.
And at the same time, you know, I know when I worked on their stuff, I really liked it. And I, you know, you just want to bring your A game. And if you bring your A game, if you don't, you know, rest on your laurels and, you know, you just really concentrate and work on it, it's going to pay off in the long run. Before we wrap up, let me just, bring this on the table. So you find the job, you've negotiated a fair price. You guys got any advice for actually collecting the money? Because I've got some nightmare stories about that actually people have told me and about actually ending up getting paid. And usually
50% up front.
That's what I would say.
That's my thing.
50% you know? Up front and don't be ultra surprised if you never see anything else.
No,
later.
You know what it is? If you don't know a client and they just come out of the blue,
right.
It's 50% up front and all the money that comes to you when you finally deliver the project, which means you got the final content. If you want this disc, I need the rest of the money. It's just that simple.
Yep.
And, oh, well, I'll get it to you tomorrow. Nah, you know, hold this to tomorrow.
No, that's so important, though. You really have to lay out your terms as soon as you make that deal.
Absolutely.
Like, you have to say, you know what, 50% up front, and then final payment upon delivery. And if that means when they come in and you're going to do the layback or you're going to do the mix down or whatever, you just state that up front. I think a lot of people get in problems when they don't talk about the money and they don't talk about the terms and they just kind of leaving it, this gray area. Mm-hmm. And you really do have to be, I mean, I can't stress enough how important it is for people to be really clear and concise on the payment and how you're going to collect the money and who's the check going to be made out to.
Well, you're going to learn that lesson. Right. You're either going to learn it the easy way or the hard way. The easy way is to listen now and learn it. The hard way is someone will screw you.
Yeah.
There's no question. You can get half up front. You could get three quarters up front. Getting that balance payment, if you give them their final delivery without having the final payment figured out, eventually, you know, it's not going to turn out well for you.
And also, I think something even harder, which I think a lot of us have found out, if you're working with, let's say, a big company, really big company, and you're a small peon,
right,
you get paid last.
Yeah.
Because it's not like you're going to sue them.
Right.
It's, or you can even harass them. They'll get around paying you when they get around paying you, and that's just the way it is. And it's bad business practices. But in a normal business company, they have 30 days to pay you at least.
Right.
From when their milestone is. We've been in situations where we have a gig that's only 3 weeks long, and the first payment is going to be 30 days,
yeah,
which means we're way finished with the project. The final payment, when we finish the project, is 30 days after that.
Right.
And it's not unusual for them to go 120 days without paying us.
But you know what? I found that if you work with a big company and you tell them up the front that, you know what, I need the check now.
And if they need your services enough, a check will show up.
Oh, yeah, sure.
A check will definitely show up. I've been in a situation where, you know, I've said, you know what, I need a check at the end of the session. And sure enough, at the end of the session, they had a check there and it was signed. And all we had to do was fill in the amount.
As long as you're still holding their master.
And also, yeah. I'll give a little bit of incredibly valuable information for the people out there. And this is very valuable. We deal with a lot of international companies. Okay. Yeah, try collecting internationally.
Yeah, no.
So it's like, yeah. So what we've done is we open escrow accounts that they have to put all the money in the escrow account, and then the escrow company will pay you. But before the money's there, we'll say, great, we'd love to do the gig. Let's say it's $150,000. Great. Put the $150,000 in an escrow account. They won't pay us until we deliver you the final product, so they don't get screwed. And we know the money's actually in a U.S. escrow account that the moment we finish and they feel it's good, the escrow company has to give us the money. And it's a great way. We found out the hard way. We did not use an escrow company, and we didn't get paid for big bucks.
Wow.
Big bucks.
What's the what would you say would be the price range? Like if you're doing a project for $14,000, is that worth going to an escrow account? If you're
it depends. If $14,000, you go, who cares if I get paid?
Right. Yeah, can you afford to not get, paid and right, spend the time not?
I mean, it's $14,000 and 3 days work. 3 days of my work. Who cares? But all of a sudden, if it's $14,000 and that's coming straight to me.
Sure.
That's a lot of money to me.
Yeah.
Then guess what?
How do the escrow companies get paid? A percentage, or is it a flat fee?
There's usually a flat fee that usually gets done, and it has to deal with the buyer.
Wow.
We don't pay.
Now, let me tell you another piece of advice that just recently happened to me, and that's if you're going to strike a deal with a production company or a record label, really listen to what people say about that company. Because that'll keep you out of situations. So your gut feeling on people and on production companies, a lot of times you should really listen to that. Because I just, as a matter of fact, before I went on vacation, I turned down, you know, an animated series, that I was going to be hired to do, based on a recommendation of the post-production supervisor who was going to hire me for the gig. The production company owed him $20,000. So it's like, you know, if he can't collect his, his $20,000, it's like, I do not want to go in that situation where, you know, you end up having to hire editors and you end up having to hire, you know, rooms and mixing and things like that. It's just like, you just don't want to even get in that situation. So no matter how rosy of a picture they're going to paint about this and that and try to work points on the backside, you know, it's just, it's just, I just don't even want to deal with that. You know?
Well, we've said it's an industry of relationships and reputations, and your reputation is everything.
Yeah.
And also you've got to be, if you are busy, even if you're not making that much money,
right.
The moment you're busy, it's capitalism. All of a sudden, if you want me, price just went up.
Right.
Because now I've got more work than I can handle. And if that happens, well, okay, there's $1,000 there. $1,200.
Yeah.
$1,200. Do I hear $1,400?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you want me, I'm booked.
Right.
It's even with relationships. People want what they can't have.
Right.
And if they find out there's somebody who's really great, oh, my God, we have to have this guy.
Well, that's true. And the other thing, too, is you have to realize that when you work with a company and you're going to set your hourly rate with that company, your hourly rate will never go up with that company.
Oh, know? Right. Yeah.
You have
that's
to be
it for life.
Wow.
Yeah.
Same with the government.
Yeah.
So it's sure. just be prepared. So, just take that all into consideration when you start pricing yourself. It's just, we're going to wrap this up, but, people out there have to just really, take care of themselves. Don't be afraid to know your worth and to ask your worth. And quite frankly, nobody's going to give you that raise.
Never work for free.
Right. Absolutely. I think that's a really great point, is even if they give you gas money or, money for a plug-in or something, at least if you get something, if there's some value attached to your work, it's going to make the project always go better. And always know that the project that pays you the least is probably going to give you the biggest pain in the butt.
That is true.
Especially, and if you're doing any type of post-production, the clients that pay the least are going to be the ones with the biggest mouth.
They're going to show up the least prepared because they've skimped on every other part of the project, and it's going to be a nightmare. That has proven to be true so many times.
All right. Well, we're running a little long, so we're going to be wrapping this up. And as you noticed, Martin is not with us.
He got strangely silent, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Actually, he had to go because he had to go to a, I'll just say this between us, a press check for his CD. So,
It's that close.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, cool.
Nobody heard that though. Okay.
No. Of course not.
But, he has to do that tomorrow. So he's not with us. But, thank you so much, Ann and Bill. I appreciate this. And,
thank you.
What a fascinating, topic, just to how data and just the archiving and I wish you guys luck, I really
thank
do.
Thank you. You guys too.
Let's give a shout out to the two Kens. We've got our backup scientist, Ken.
Right.
And our engineer, Ken.
Ken Kane. And let me ask you one quick question before we go on this whole data thing. So data is a commitment. So basically, as soon as you record something, it's like having a kid. It's your kid now, and it's your responsibility to take advantage of all the storage medias that are out there because nobody's going to take care of this data but you in the long run.
That's right.
That's true.
Absolutely.
Wow. I got to do some backups.
Yeah. I think we all go home and do some backups.
My children are in danger.
Yeah, if you put it like that.
So, Rob, you up to anything? Anything you're working on right now that you can talk about?
Let me think. Well, we're actually delivering the M&E version of the feature film we mixed earlier this year, that Devil Girl film.
Oh, great.
And thank you, Scott, for teaching me exactly what an M&E is. For people who don't know, it's the music and effects
it's
only
the blue
version.
And the purple M&Ms.
it's the version of the film that can be used for foreign,
right.
So it doesn't have any English dialogue in it. So we're preparing that right now.
Did you have to replace a lot of production effects?
We're in the middle of doing that now. We're actually having to do a lot of Foley,
right.
Because the production sound was not recorded all that cleanly from the dialogue. So there's a lot of places that once we take out the dialogue,
right.
We have to rebuild the effects around. So we're doing that. I'm doing promos for the Dr. Phil show.
Wow.
And, and working on two albums that I'll be able to talk about soon.
Great. And Scott?
I'm actually seeing daylight now. And the reason why I wasn't here for the last two podcasts, I just finished a wonderful, wonderful film called In the Valley of Elah with Charlize Theron, Tommy Lee Jones, Paul Haggis, who won the Oscar for Crash.
Wow.
And it was quite a joy. It was sonically it was like jazz. We were using a lot of silence, and Mark Isham did the music, and it was quite a great project. And We just finished that up last Friday. So then I get about a week and a half off, and then I start a new project called The Express, which is also – the script's amazing. I've seen some footage. It's about a football player named Ernie Davis, first black Heisman Trophy winner, which takes me all the way into the end of the year. But also we had our another kickoff, because we like to have kickoffs, for the IESD San Francisco.
Right.
It's been a while since I've seen you guys.
Right, it has been a while.
Interactive Entertainment Sound Developers.
Oh, that's great. And Anne, any final party thoughts on data, archive, storage, any of that? Are you guys working on anything, any cool top secret
technology?
Well,
we're sending the Deep Impact spacecraft off to harass another comet.
Bill, if people wanted, what was that website again, if they wanted to find some of this information and just the archive itself?
Yeah, it's PDS for Planetary Data System, so pds.nasa.gov.
Well, thank you both. It's been fascinating, and it's just really great to see how it all kind of all data and clocking all kind of intertwines with our lives.
So
it's really cool. Well, if you have any comments or questions, and if you want us to forward any comments or questions to Ann or Bill, you can always reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you can also check out our MySpace page at myspace.com/audionowcast. Well, guys, it's been a great podcast, and from myself and everybody else here, we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbatier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaolo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.